I would like to discuss some generalizations of what we have done in the previous weeks. So we described bosonic string moving in some flat space-time. How can we generalize that? The simplest thing we can do is to consider a space-time which is not flat. Could you guess an action for a string moving in a curved space-time? Yes, that's fine. So we need the area, too. And all these manipulations we did to go from Nammu-Goto action to Polyakov action work in any space-time. So we could write an action like this. So, and we can gauge fix it. Again, we can fix the metric to be locally flat and so on if we have well symmetry. What's the most striking difference with respect to what we had before?
The metric depends on x.
That's right. This is not a free action. So there are two consequences of this. First, we don't really know how to do calculations. That's secondary for now. But first, because it's not a free action, all sort of interesting phenomena will happen, which are renormalization. So we can pick this metric, right? We can write an action like this classically, but quantum mechanically we'll have to put a cutoff on the worksheet. And then we'll have to adjust this is like a coupling. We have to adjust this coupling so that when we send the cutoff to infinity, we remain with finite amount, with finite answers. And at the end, generically, my couplings will still depend on some scale. And the theory will not be scale invariant on the worksheet. In particular, lack of scale invariance means lack of wild symmetry, because wild symmetry is a very special, I mean, scale transformations are a very special wild symmetry. So generically, this theory is not okay for describing a string theory, the worksheet of a string, because it's not wild invariant. Right? The violation of wild invariance is control of scale invariance, first of all, is controlled by the beta function for this coupling, sort of generalized coupling. One way to think about the beta function is that it controls the lack of tracelessness of the stress tensor. So for every coupling, the beta function for some coupling is, which multiplies some operators in the action, is the coefficient with which the same operator appears in the trace of the stress tensor. So in this case, the beta function for the metric is whatever happens to multiply this operator. I mean, whenever I write something like this, you can imagine it in perturbation theory, sort of expanding it in powers of x. So this metric sort of contains infinitely many couplings. Now, you might wonder, why is this happening? Why is this possible? In dimension higher than 2, an action like this would just not be renormalizable at all. Because x would be dimensionful. This would have already you know, this is a kinetic term, would already be off top of the, of would already be marginal, so all of these would be irrelevant. But in two dimensions, scalar fields are dimensionless, scaling dimension zero. So any sort of coupling like this is marginal. And you have some operator in front, some coefficient, some coupling in front, which will flow. Something like this is called the nonlinear sigma model. Now, of course, once we start flowing, we are going to turn on a lot of other operators, which are marginal or relevant, right? For example, functions of x. Let me just ignore those for now, and I will account for them later. So all I want to say is, for now, this theory will be well symmetric only if, so this beta function is some functional of the matrix. So the theory will be scale invariant, right, if and only if this beta function vanishes. It's not obvious, but it's generally expected to be true, and actually I think even proven in two dimension, that if you have a theory which is scale invariant in two dimension, will also be well invariant. So essentially, if you want to use a sigma model for your string moving in spacetime, or any other theory, you need to sort of pick a theory which is scale invariant, which is a conformal field theory. Now, in order to understand what this constraint looks like, I need to, by the way, right, so this beta function is also what would appear in some equation like this. Sorry. I use mu both for scales and for but the same thing as you would have defined the beta function for any other coupling. It's useful to put a parameter in front of the action, just to, it's sort of like an H bar on the worksheet. If you want your axis to be dimensionful, this will be dimensionful too. This is the string. This contains the string scale we're discussing before. For example, the mass squared of string states will be a multiple of 4 of alpha prime. Now, this is useful. Why? Because, as I said, this is an interactive theory. I don't know how to think about it, except as, the easiest way to think about it is a perturbation of something free, right? So I can imagine expanding, sort of expanding around the classical, a flat space-time. And do a perturbation theory in alpha prime. As I said, this is 1 over alpha prime is completely analogous to a 1 over h bar in front of the action in quantum field theory. So if you do perturbative calculations on the worksheet, then the loop expansion on the worksheet will be controlled by powers of alpha prime. Do not confuse this with the loop expansion of string theory. So string theory is a sum over worksheets of various topology, right? And those are the loops in space-time. But here I'm just trying to do calculations on a single worksheet, perturbatively in alpha prime. Then I can compute the beta function perturbatively. And the leading order in perturbation theory, it looks like this. It looks like the Ricci curvature. So I'm working with a space-time which is almost flat. It has, you know, weak curvature, and I'm working perturbatively in this parameter, and the first order in perturbation theory, I get something like that. So this is telling you that I can define the stereo strings moving in the background G at the leading order if and only if the metric is Ricci flat. So the metric satisfies the Einstein equations. Now this, we observed that the theory had a graviton, right? So it's natural to imagine that this graviton describes more fluctuations to this background metric. But that makes sense only if the background metric satisfies some reasonable equations of motion. So perhaps this result is not completely unexpected, but still it's quite striking that just the consistency condition of requiring that you can define a theory of a string moving in a certain background requires the background to satisfy Einstein equations. So this is the second way. So somehow we have encountered gravity at this moment in two ways. We found the graviton, and now we found the Einstein equations for the background metric. Momentarily, I'll try to describe how these two happenstances are connected. Do you have any questions? Mm-hmm.
Is that alpha prime goes to zero?
Yes. Prime? Yes, that's right. So the Heidegger corrections are alpha prime squared, alpha prime cubed, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
This is going to be the linear additive ratio, right?
Not quite. I did not assume that the metric was. I was not working the linear order around flat space. I was working the linear order in curvature. It's slightly different. So my space time. Was not I didn't assume that I had a metric that was everywhere flat, the same as flat space, except for some small fluctuation. I just assumed that the curvature was small. I did not show you how to do this calculation, so telling you what I assumed or not is perhaps a little bit. Is not a great statement. But for now, let me just say that when you do this calculation of a beta function of the sigma model in perturbative and alpha prime, this is what you get at the linear order in alpha prime, non-linearly in G. And then there will be terms that look like alpha prime squared, alpha prime cubed, R cubed, and so on and so forth. Now, how would you do a calculation like that? How would you compute the beta function for this metric?
Get the stress energy.
Right. That would be one way. You can just try to write down the stress energy in terms of this. Try to make sure it's, define it by point splitting. and try to make sure that it's conserved and take the trace. Another possibility is to compute the beta function in the standard way. You look for divergences, right? You subtract them off. There'll be some logarithm of the scale, and then you do your normalization, and then you extract the scale variation of the counter term. So if one loop, this comes from a one loop calculation. I don't know if this is actually, is this part or going to be part of a tutorial?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm doing not exactly, not the beta function, but I'm doing more than the complexification part.
Okay. I mean, there are all sorts of questions when you try to define this model quantum mechanically beyond a classical field theory. For example, if you're really trying to talk about a sigma model of a manifold non-trivial topology, you have to use, glue together different patches to make the manifold. You glue together patches by some nonlinear transformation of coordinates, x goes to some function of x. But you can surely worry about how the measure is going to behave under those transformations. So the classical transformation of the action will be modified. All these modifications happen perturbatively in alpha prime. So the way the metric is glued together between patches will change at order alpha prime, because the measure will, the transformation of coordinate x goes to function of x prime will change the measure by some amount, which starts at order 1 instead of 1 over alpha prime. So the very notion of a manifold, right, of a sigma model into manifold, will start breaking down if you go away from alpha prime goes to 0. Everything, the very notion of a sigma model into a manifold, it's a perturbative notion in alpha prime. But in perturbation theory, it makes sense to do calculations like this. As far as I remember, the way you typically do these calculations is that you first pick a convenient coordinate system locally around the point of your manifold. Something where the metric looks like the flat metric plus something like this. I'm trying to remember, I hope I remember it right, but there is something of this sort. I might have the indices wrong. So there are coordinates called Riemann normal coordinates, which have the property that there are at least around a certain point of space-time, the metric is flat plus the quadratic correction, controlled by the Ricci tensor, the Riemann tensor. This is an expansion which, So if you want, this is the leading interaction. Sometimes it also goes like x, x, del x, del x. And then you do some diagram using this interaction to get the correction to get the RG flow. And the diagram ends up contracting some indices and giving you something like the Ricci tensor at that point. So now, to make contact between this sort of reasoning that leads to the nonlinear Einstein equations and the statement that there is a graviton in the spectrum, we can do the following exercise. So suppose I have my full path integral for the string theory. So now I'm really going to expand linearly. So at this point, I'm really going to say, suppose that I work at the linearized order. Okay. And I'm trying to do a calculation, a standard calculation. On a worksheet with some insertions and this deformed action. One thing I can do is to try to expand in power series in the variation of the action. Now, we need to satisfy the Einstein equations, now the linearized Einstein equations, right? So if I work in, I can Fourier expand my fluctuation of the metric. But this is going to be transverse and piece concentrated on p squared equal to zero and so on. Now, this looks a lot like the scattering amplitude, actually it's precisely a scattering amplitude in the original, in flat space with the original insertions and n insertions of gravitons of the graviton vertex operator. Because this is literally the graviton vertex operator, and we are integrating n of them over the worksheet. So this is the connection between the two ways gravity is appearing. We said that every string state, right, in the BRST spectrum had some form G tensor M, right, which mapped to some CC bar V of M, and perhaps to an integrated form after I contracted with some B ghosts, or something like that. This V is some vertex operator, right? Such that the L0 of this was zero, which means the L0 of this state was one. Right? So this was a state which had L0 eigenvalues and L0 bar eigenvalue, one. So this controls the scaling dimensions and the spin of the corresponding operator. So Vm has spin zero, which is L0 minus L0 bar in value, and has dimension two. So an operator of dimension two and no spin is precisely the sort of thing that you can that is a marginal operator in my worksheet theory. It's precisely the thing that I could add to the action to try to deform the background where the string moves. Perhaps unsurprisingly, right, the condition that this state is on shell, right, does the state that this state is PRST closed. So that's also the condition for this infinitesimal deformation of the action to preserve PRST symmetry, which makes sense. We know that we need wild symmetry in order to have PRST symmetry. So it's consistent. This calculation, though, gave me something more, gave me a nonlinear beta function, nonlinear equations of motions, of which this is the linearized form. Now, if you look at an expression like this, and you try to make sure that this whole expression is PRST closed, it turns out that there are some subtle contributions from places where these vertex operators are hitting each other. They're called PRST anomalies. Some ways scattering amplitudes can fail to be PRST invariant, although naively ours never look like it. So these anomalies give you nonlinear effects, which are precisely mapped to this. Another way to say that is that this sort of calculation is reconstructing the equations of motions, the low energy effective action associated to the string theory scattering amplitudes. I mean, if you're working with a quantum field theory and you're trying to figure out what is the low energy effective action for some fields, what do you do? Right. So one way is you take your scattering amplitudes, right, at all loops, and with all the particles propagating in intermediate channels. Then you pick some low energy, some light particles you want to build your effective action for. And you build the actions systematically whose three-level amplitudes reproduce the scattering amplitudes you have been given. That defines for you the low energy effective action. If you do the same calculations in string theory, step by step, with a little bit of help from BRST symmetry as a guidance, you'll discover that the calculations you're doing are the same as the ones that would end up giving you the expansion of this beta function order by order in the couplings. It's not an obvious statement, but if you just go down into the details, it works, and it sort of has to work, I think, if one has a good enough understanding of, I mean, it's probably automatically true that it has to work, but showing it well probably would require understanding better the PRST MBV formalism than we do at the moment. So, in any case, what we see here for the metric generalizes for every other string mode. In particular, it generalizes for the massless string modes, also the tachyons. So, when we start looking at the sigma model, as I said, we should really include all possible terms that we can write down that are marginal or relevant in this perturbation theory. So for example, we would have to add also something like this. And perhaps also something, like I mentioned before, a coupling of a a true form to the string worksheet. But this is anti-symmetric instead of being symmetric. And if your worksheet is curved, I translated there is another term that you might want to include when you do a normalization, which has to do with the Ricci tensor on the Ricci curvature on the worksheet. Now, when you write down this most general action, and you can write down some beta functions, which now will depend on the metric on this and these other fields. And these beta functions being set to zero will give you the equations of motion, the low energy effective action, for the string modes that correspond to infinitesimal fluctuations of these graphs. If you look at what they correspond to, this is the B field, this is the tachyon, and this is the dilaton. So this gives you an alternative way to compute and understand the low energy effective action of string theory. I said that low energy string theory behaves like quantum field theory. The scattering amplitudes look like quantum field theory scattering amplitudes. You can assemble them into low energy effective action by just computing them and working backwards. It's a lot of work. Or you can compute the beta functions for the corresponding backgrounds. And the results will be the same. Now, it's not completely obvious, but these beta functions can be indeed written as variation of some effective action. This fact that the beta functions of the quantum field theory are always the gradient of an action is not obvious in general dimension. I think it has not been proven in general dimension, although it seems to be often the case. I think in two dimension it's a theorem, which surely makes sense in the context of string theory. Although in principle, well, there are some caveats there, and not all theories have actions. And actually, in superstring, there is an example of a type 2B string theory. It does not quite have a nice action because there are some self-dual gauge fields. But at least the beta functions behave like equations of motion for fields. Let me at least leave it at that. That is a statement I can stand by. If you allow myself to ignore the tachyon, which of course I shouldn't, but if I pretend that this is a good theory which does not have a tachyon, and I just set the tachyon to zero by hand, the effective action that you get is something like this. Any questions?
So maybe I'm missing something, but how is it that you have an anti-symmetric B field contracted with two copies of X mu?
There is del and del bar.
Right, but isn't that essentially the same as del A, del B with the metric, which is also symmetric?
No, precisely not. So because this is anti-symmetric, if you expand it in components, it looks like this. So the coupling to the B field does not involve the metric on the worksheet, okay. Not the metric on space-time. It's purely topological in that way. Mm-hmm. It's the integral of a true form on a true cycle. This is also a pretty funny coupling. The dilaton vertex operator and the dilaton coupling is always sort of messy. But you can see that, for example, if I take a constant dilaton, right, this integral of the Ricci curvature on the worksheet will give you a constant, which actually counts the number of loops in the worksheet. So a change in the value of the dilaton turns out into shifting the coupling of your string, theory. Because the integral of the Ricci curvature is proportional to something like 1 minus the genus. No, it's something 4 pi for a sphere is 0 for a torus, is minus 4 pi for a genus true surface, and so on and so forth. Any more questions? I'm sorry, I know that this lecture is a bit too compressed, so we're trying to find ways to go through the topic in a smoother way. But I want to get to deep brains and to superstrings by the end of the week, and time is really getting short. So computing these beta functions is the way I discussed is doable. You can find a lot of notes online to see how the calculation is done. It's a one-loop calculation. Really, the only trick is to think of using these coordinate systems. Once you use this coordinate system, the answer is fine. Also, right, as I was remarking, coordinate transformations are a symmetry of this action at the leading order to the alpha prime corrections. Right. And so at the leading order, the answer of the functions had to be something with two indices with a certain scaling dimension and a functional of the metric, which is the diffeomorphism invariant. And the Ricci curvature is pretty much the only thing that could have appeared there. So again, finding the Ricci curvature here is not terribly mysterious. And right, more generally, you know, an action like this is pretty much, apart from the specific, you know, one thing I can mention, just of terminology, is that this is an action written in what's called a string frame. When you have a sphere of gravity with a scalar field, you can always redefine the metric by some function of the scalar field, something like g goes to e to the alpha phi g. When I wrote this action, I used the conventions that correspond to this act. So what I call the metric G was what appeared in front of del x. When you compare this metric and this action with the particles you actually see at low energy, right, well, you see from this is not exactly the Einstein action because it has this e to the minus 2 phi in front. This e to the minus 2 phi in front is there because being this an effective action, it has one of the overcoupling squared in front. And as I said, the dilaton behaves like a change in the coupling. So if there is a 1 over g squared, there better be also be an e to the minus 2 phi. But if you are trying to extract physics from this action, you might want to just redefine g. It's just a redefinition of the fields. And if you pick your phi, your power of phi correctly, you can end up with another action, which has just the standard Einstein term plus stuff. That is called the Einstein frame. It is also useful if you want to really understand the relation between the string scale, the string coupling, and the Planck scale. So if you do this exercise, see there are sort of two dimensional quantities, which are the Planck scale, you know, what appears in front of the Ricci curve term in the action, the Einstein-Hilbert term in the action. And then there is the string scale defined by this alpha prime, by the mass of the strings. Doing this exercise, you can figure out that the string coupling constant is controlling the ratio between the string scale and the Planck scale. So the strings are weakly coupled when the string scale is much lower than the Planck scale. As the string coupling increases, the string scale approaches the Planck scale. So this kind of makes sense. Right. If we want to solve the problems of gravity in a perturbative way, we better do so before gravity becomes strongly coupled. So before the Planck, well before the Planck scale.
Mm-hmm. Is there any significance of the they're having a minus sign in front? Normally, if it matter, it would be like house in one.
Sorry, I think there is some matter here of just a convention, so I don't think there is anything deep here. I think this is the standard sign for the kinetic term. This is the wrong sign, but when you go to the Einstein frame, this sign switches around and you get to something sensible. The tachyon is tachyonic. I think this action is fine. Of course, I might have gotten a sign wrong when I was copying it, but I hope that's not the case. Okay, so this is pretty much all that I will have time to say about strings that move in a space-time, which is weakly curved and is approximately similar to the flat space. So if you want, everything here is happening at scales which are much lower than the Planck scale. Now, it would be great to be able to explore, at least partially, what happens when instead we look at spacetimes where the length scales start being small. But now we cannot do so with strongly curved spacetimes because we just don't know how to solve the corresponding sigma models. But we can have spacetimes which have short distances without being curved. Right. A very simple example would be a spacetime which has a direction which is periodic. So if I want to explore how string theory behaves when I go away from the quantum field theory weakly curved regime, large scales regime, I might perhaps consider string theory moving in a background that looks like arch 24.1 times a circle or some radius. And ask what happens when this radius becomes small. This will probably be a very different regime from that. Here I was assuming flat space-time was more or less the same as flat space with fluctuations or deformations. Of scales that are much larger than the string scale. So that this is here, I can try to do the opposite. And this is still described by free theory. The only difference is that now I have 25 standard scalar fields. Be 0 to 24. And an extra scalar field, which describes the the motion along the circle, and so has the property that y is identified with y plus 2 pi r. So if I understand the scalar field on the worksheet, which is periodic, I can start the string moving in a periodic spacetime. This is something that can be analyzed very much in the same way as we did before. The only difference is that when we expand this field in modes, we need to allow for this periodicity. So we get an extra, so there are two differences. First of all, the momentum will end up being quantized, because this is a conjugate variable to a periodic variable. So like in quantum mechanics, the momentum of a particle on a circle is quantized. But the second difference is that I need to allow for winding. So I can study configuration, so the scalar field goes around W times as sigma goes around once. And then there is the usual mode expansion. So now A0 and A0 bar, that are the zero modes of del phi and del bar phi, receive a contribution both from P and from W. So we have something like this. So let me, because P is quantized, let me give another name to it. Let's call it M over R, where M is an integer. So A0 will be now M over R minus RW over 2, and A0 bar will be M over R plus RW over 2. Now, if I ignore the modes with non-zero W, the string spectrum is pretty much just the Kaluza-Klein reduction of the string spectrum in flat space, right? I'll have momentum modes for the other fields, and then some P in direction Y, which is M over R. Suppose I set W equal to 0, then enacted oscillators, then I will get no new constraints. Everything will be the same as before, except that the momentum is quantized. So for example, so I will get the usual string spectrum together with Kaluza-Klein towers of states. But I get new states by allowing the winding to be generic. See, the Kaluza-Klein spectrum had mass scale set by 1 over r. These new states will have masses controlled by r. Now, if I had kept alpha prime, those scales would be 1 over r and alpha prime r, to be precise. So this is the Kaluza-Klein scale. This is sort of the winding mode scale. And then there is the string scale, which is the scale of the massive string modes. So when R is very large, when the radius is very large compared to alpha prime, what do I see? I see my usual graviton and B field, and then a tower of Kaluza-Klein modes just above it. Right? And then at much higher scale set by alpha prime, I get a massive string states with their Kaluza-Klein towers. And then high up, I'll get the winding modes. is for r much greater alpha prime. But as r approaches alpha prime, all of these scales are collapsing together. Square root of one over square root of alpha prime. So when the radius of the circle approaches this, the typical length of the string, the spectrum changes completely. The theory stops looking like a Zwicklian reduction of the theory in 26 dimensions. How does it look like? Well, there is a trick. The trick is to define a new scalar field which is conjugate to winding instead of momentum. Should probably call this M over R still. Where we keep the same sign for the ans and switch the sign for the a minus for the a n bars. So in terms of currents, the currents of this new field are almost the same as the currents of the old field with a crucial sign difference. So it turns out that the theory of a scalar field, wrapped periodic scalar field, is described equally well by the original scalar field or by this new dual scalar field. So there is a way to reorganize the degrees of freedom into a new field and forget about the old one. In doing so, exchanges perfectly the role of momentum and winding. So this is telling you that if you make the radius so small that this is the lowest scale, the new states that are coming up from infinity will organize themselves just in a way that mimics Kaluza-Klein towers, but for a radius, for a circle of radius alpha prime r, 1 over alpha prime r. So if you take string theory on a circle and you make the circle very small, at some point, you get turned around, and it looks like there is, again, a big circle in your theory. Now, this kind of makes sense, because after all, we know the string theory has to live in 26 dimensions, bosonic string theory has to live in 26 dimensions. Usually, if you have a quantum field theory, and you put it on a circle of small radius, make the radius very small, the direction just disappears in space-time. But this cannot happen in string theory, because you cannot have a string, a well-defined critical string in 25 dimensions. So the way string theory deals with that is by creating a new direction in which to propagate out of the winding modes for the whole direction. If you stay at some intermediate scale, so that all of these scales are the same order, then you just get some theory which has, you know, an interesting rich spectrum, which is just different from what you would get from Kaluza-Klein reduction waves. So T-duality is the first example of string theory duality, telling you that string theory in some background is secretly the same as string theory in some other background. This is an example of a sort of weak coupling duality. We had a weakly coupled string theory in some background. We say this is the same as a weakly coupled string theory in some other background. This is interesting, but there are other dualities, which we'll describe later, which are even more interesting because they take string theory at strong coupling and relate it to some other string theory, a weak coupling in a different background. But in order to do that, we'll have to introduce this notion of D-brains in order to get new degrees of freedom. Here we could have this duality. Why? Because there were these winding modes, which are new degrees of freedom, which came, which were very, very heavy when the circle was large, but become elementary when the circle becomes small. Similarly, d-brains will give us new degrees of freedom, which are very, very heavy when the coupling is large, is small, but become lighter and more elementary when the coupling becomes strong. Of course, again, this is boson extreme, so this duality is only as useful as, you know, it's relating to what Chouil defined theories with Darkness, but there will be versions of string of t-duality which survive to in superstring theory. Do you have any questions? I mean, I invite you to definitely take the spectrum of the look at the spectrum of the scalar field on the circle, make sure that this is truly a symmetry. You know, this is a, so t-duality is an interesting tool, not just in string theory. It's an interesting property of two-dimensional quantum field theories. Now, when you study quantum field theories of a periodic boson like the XY model in two dimensions. The momentum is a conserved charge for a symmetry, which is manifest. It's just translations along this circle. Winding is a conserved charge for a symmetry which is not manifest. Naively, in a sense, it's an emergent symmetry at low energy. So part of the reason you can do something like this is that del y and del bar y are separately conserved. So you can reassemble them into a new conserved current. If you had some interacting non-conformal theory, left and right part of the current would not be separately conserved. It becomes separately conserved in infrared. It's a consequence of conformal symmetry. So that means that in a physical system of a periodic scalar, usually you have interactions which break t-duality. But still, t-duality can be interesting in the sense that it allows you to convert interactions which break winding into interactions which break translation symmetry, and gives you a new insight on a two-dimensional system. Anyway. Those of you that have curiosities about anomalies, SPT phases, and things like that in condensed matter physics might ask yourselves under which conditions a two-dimensional theory can have momentum and winding symmetry both unbroken. That's an advanced exercise. Okay.